This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
12 men have just discovered something. For 100,000 years, it was buried in the snow and ice. Now it has found a place to live. Inside. Where no one can see it. Or hear it. Or feel it.
Welcome, everybody, to yet another episode of Cinematica Animalia, the podcast where we break down the biology of movie monsters. Today we're looking at John Carpenter's The Thing, a 1982 horror classic. We'll also be touching on some stuff from the 2011 prequel, and the original book. We'll go over some news first, a little bit of interactive news, I'm quite looking forward to it. Tell you a bit about the movie, our thoughts, and then get stuck into the science that this movie brings up, including colonial organisms, the concept of assimilation, overwintering, and I really want to talk about, we already talked about this a couple of weeks ago in the Parasite episode, but whether humans are the best choice for this creature. As always, the show's broke up into a few different segments. I will have time codes below so you can skip ahead to the bits you're looking for. But before we get into that, my name, as always, is Sam Perrin. I am a freshwater / invasive ecologist and climate data analyst based in Trondheim, Norway. I also run the website Ecology for the Masses alongside co-host Adam Harsick, a parasite / disease ecologist at the University of Arkansas. With Adam, as always, is Libby Young, our story specialist and writer at Short Story Soup. And as always, we're joined by Dave, a vet and our movie physiologist. Before we get further into the episode, we kind of teased an episode with Dr. Kirsty MacLeod a couple of weeks ago. That episode is coming. It'll be out next week. We just had some technical difficulties. We didn't record Kirsty's sections properly, and she's put a massive amount of effort into going back and re-recording all her stuff. So thanks again, Kirsty, and we'll have that for you next week. So just hang tight. Now, news this week. Dave and Libby haven't seen this. Adam has. I think it's absolutely hilarious. But there has been the results of a survey online doing the rounds this week on Twitter. And we often talk about, you know, humans facing off against animals. And this survey was very much along those lines. The concept was they asked a bunch of people from male and female which animals they thought they could beat in a fight. And what I want to do is go through some of the animals and get Dave and Libby to guess the percentage of men and women that people put down that they thought that they could beat this certain animal in a fight.
No.
Interesting.
Well, let's start with a classic that we covered, you know, 2 or 3 weeks ago, wolf. What percentage of women do you think thought that they could beat a wolf in a fight, unarmed?
I'm gonna say 30% of women.
I'm gonna guess 8%.
Libby was much closer. It was 9.
Wow.
How many men do you reckon? What percentage of men?
I'm imagining something like 70% of men thought they could beat a wolf in a fight.
I'm guessing like 35.
16.
Wow.
So,
hey.
Yeah, the disparity on that isn't too
That's
huge.
Not bad.
Also, just to clarify, are we doing Price is Right rules, closest to it without going over?
I mean, Libby's got closest on both accounts so far.
Yeah, Libby's won by a large percentage on both of these two. Let's go one of my favorites then, a goose.
God.
What percentage of women?
I'm going to guess a goose, man. They're so dangerous.
Let's say
like a Russian goose, a barnacle goose, a Canadian
goose.
Just goose, yeah.
Dave, do you have a guess first?
I know I'm sticking around the same numbers here, but I'm going to guess 36%.
I'm going to go higher on this one. I'm going to say about 50%.
51% of women thought they could beat a goose in a fight.
Nice.
What do you reckon about men?
82.
71.
Yeah.
Okay. A horrifying one that we've already covered this season, Chimpanzee.
Oh, dear God.
Oh, man.
It should be zero for both of them because yeah, there's no fucking way.
So I'm assuming probably women are going to guess somewhere around like 2%. And I'm worried that probably men are somewhere around like 12%.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm going to guess for women it's like a 5%. I feel like there's some women that don't know quite how strong a chimpanzee is. Men, I feel like, I think maybe like 20%.
22% of men thought they could beat a chimpanzee in a fight. 12% of women.
I would much rather fight a wolf.
The thing is that if you go down this list, right, most of them, it wouldn't even be a fight because most of these animals would see a human and just run, right? So, yeah. But the last one I want to touch on is rat, right? What percentage of women and men do you think...
I mean, is this like Splinter from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles?
Please, or... Master Splinter.
just rat.
I'm going to say 65% of women and I'm going to say 88% of men.
Yeah, I'm going to guess 40% for women and 95% for men.
It was actually 68 and 76.
Really?
It was reasonably close at the safe ones and the really dangerous ones. It was pretty close, but then there's this massive gap when you get to like king cobra, large dog, eagle, medium-sized dog.
But the one I want to know, Sam, because you've got it in front of you. Bear.
6% for women, 7% for men.
I think that's obviously going to depend on how old this bear is, what kind of bear it is, and what situation you're in. Because if it's a polar bear, you're fucked. If it's a grizzly bear, you're fucked. Black bear, maybe. But you're probably fucked.
If it's a heavily radiated bear with its face falling off, I've heard four women are pretty well equipped to take it on.
I'm on a camping trip years ago with a group of veterinarians. So these are doctors, right? Intelligent men.
Yeah.
And we're all out in the woods and the concept comes up of like what's going to happen if a bear showed up, because a bunch of these guys have like bear mace and like bear flares and things like that. And suddenly it turns into this pissing contest with a group of what I had anticipated were these like very capable, self-aware men being like, no, like we'd fuck that bear up. We've got like hatchets and we've got like this shit. And like suddenly like it turns into this like throwing the hatchets at the tree to prove that like, yeah, they could totally, like, and then this, like, game plan develops of, like, if the bear comes in, what's the theoretical? And I suddenly found myself back on, like, an elementary playground with a group of people standing around and being like, no, like, I have a force field, so, like, I resisted your attack. And it was like, it's a fucking bear.
Yeah. Interestingly, more women than men thought they could beat a lion in a fist fight.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Huh.
I mean, it was 8% to 7%, so it's not like it was.
They probably thought they could just sing Disney songs at it. And...
Yeah.
Or with it.
Exactly.
For the bare necessities, the simple bare necessities, forget about your worries and your strife.
Today we're talking about John Carpenter's The Thing. Brief plot summary for those of you who haven't seen this before, and then we'll actually get Dave to kind of describe what The Thing does, because you kind of need to know this, and it is a little kind of complicated. Basically, you have a group of researchers, technicians, engineers, what have you, dog trainers living on an Antarctic research base. At the start of the movie, two Norwegians are flying a chopper over, chasing a random dog. They get shot down pretty quickly by people at the base. The researchers soon find out that it's not a dog. It's an alien with weird fucking tentacles and some really horrifying body horror abilities. And then they learn that it can assimilate any person down to a cellular level and even assume their memories and that sort of stuff, which Dave will talk about a bit later. And then it all just turns into one huge shitfest of paranoia, essentially. It's this incredible descent into madness in another brilliant setting. We've had some great settings lately. Next week's Annihilations is fantastic. The underwater scene and this, just the sense of isolation in the middle of the Antarctic is fantastic.
Are we like intentionally or unintentionally on this cosmic horror kick?
I love it.
I think unintentionally for at least two of these.
But I'm loving it, I'm going to say, But yeah, that's the main kind of plot. But Dave, do you want to talk a little bit about what this creature actually does? Because it's quite important to today's episode.
Yeah, so when the creature comes in contact with normal forms of life, we get to see both dog and human in the original film. it's able to assimilate that tissue, basically copying it and replicating it in such a way that it can generate new forms. Now,
and by assimilate, you mean grossly absorbing it into its own body.
Yeah, lots of tentacles.
But it doesn't always absorb, and we'll talk about that later on. But the main point just being, when this organism contacts you, whether or not it's direct assimilation or copying, it manages to copy the organism down to the cellular level where they're indistinguishable, as well as taking memories and aspects of the personality, and, as we'll be getting into a little bit later, physiological defects as well that present issues in the first movie with a number of the characters.
And it doesn't have to attack you either, like if you absorb any part of it. For instance, in the book, and we'll talk a little bit about the book, we try not to lean on it too much, but it's interesting, they actually, there's a lot of kind of background given to this character in the book. The dogs initially all tear apart the dog that is a thing, and because they've eaten that, they all get assimilated by the chunks that that they've eaten. So yeah, it doesn't necessarily have to find you and attack you. It's just any sort of absorption or skin contact can lead to your assimilation. What did we like about this movie?
I think I really enjoy just how well it holds up. This is a movie is almost 40 years old and it still looks incredible. The plot is super interesting. The characters are wonderful. And it's just, it's really well done as far as hyping up that, the anticipation, the horror, you're not really sure. They don't make it too obvious as far as who is and who is not taken over and a thing versus an actual human. And there's some mysteries that don't really seem to get answered, and I like that it is directly ambiguous at the end, especially with the director specifically saying that one of the two last people is a thing, but we don't know who.
Oh, has he said that?
Oh, yes. Cool, I didn't know that.
Huh, okay, I did not, yeah, me neither.
I don't really have anything that I don't like about this movie, honestly. I love it.
Yeah, I don't think any of us do, actually. Libby?
Yeah, no, I think this movie, like Adam was saying, I think this movie really holds up over time. I love the cosmic horror aspect of it. The physical special effects are great. It still looks disgusting in 2021. I don't want to look at some of the stuff on screen. And I really love Kurt Russell in this film. Obviously, he's fantastic.
Oh, he's amazing.
In pretty much anything that he does. And I love his 80s bomber jacket, leather jacket / gold prospector hat that he wears.
Beautiful head of hair.
And like a hoodie. Like, yeah. The whole movie, I kept trying to figure out his aesthetic. It was great.
Dave?
Yeah, I'm in the same boat of this is still one of my like favorite horror films. I got my partner to rewatch it a couple of weeks ago, and she absolutely hates more horror movies and loved this. She thought it was just like really well done. She thought the characters were like really fleshed out. They acted really naturally. The plot flows like really well as things go. And it's just, as Adam was saying, the decision to do practical special effects in terms of like what they designed mechanically and the way that they got that to work, it just holds up so well. And have either of you guys seen the 2011 The Thing, Sam?
Nope.
Unfortunately not.
I've been through bits of it.
So I did watch it last night, and the decision to do CGI, I do not recommend that film. It has some cool elements that I'll be leaning on for some of my physiology discussions that it added to. But generally speaking, it was a much worse film compared to, and just not that same level of tension and paranoia that builds throughout that film in this cold, isolated place with this real stakes that if this creature gets back to the real world, single drop of it in the water source, a contact with another human, how rapidly it would spread, makes this movie just fascinating.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think the paranoia is just so kind of omnipresent. It really just creeps in, the descent into madness. Nobody's just an asshole for no reason. You totally understand, like, the reasons they're going kind of mad. That feeling of isolation, like I said, the setting in Antarctica is fantastic. I think this is, just a fantastic movie. I love seeing Keith David in stuff as well.
Yeah, he's always great.
He is just a fantastic actor. Yeah, I don't understand why he's not in more things, but... Yeah,
we've started replaying through the Mass Effect trilogy, the game series, and Keith David plays a pretty major character in that series, so it's wonderful hearing his voice again. He's
just got such a good voice, yeah.
He also plays the ambiguity, Arbiter, like, games.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. The ambiguity, like Adam mentioned, I think is fantastic. Well, like the director constantly saying he meant to leave everything, you know, up to interpretation. Fan theories have run wild surrounding this film.
I also, it's the concept that the thing, like a lot of these guys seem to be fairly close. They have these relationships. They've got to know each other. The idea that you're simultaneously angry at the thing that killed your friend that is your friend, that acts like your friend and responds like your friend, creates this wonderful, like, anger, fear, horror response, which just so good.
For stuff I didn't like, I just had written down, fuck, I don't know, it looks really cold. There were some of those scenes where people aren't wearing a beanie, and I'm like, please, for God's sake, put on a, what do you call them, Dave? A toque?
Toque.
Put on a toque. And I was going to say that I think the effects look a little bit cheesy these days, but having also seen a lot of the scenes from the 2011 film, I'm like, still better. And, okay, moving into trivia now, they actually did try to do a lot of those scenes in the 2011 film practically. And then the studio came in and basically said, no, this is ridiculous, use CGI. Yeah. They had, you know, that massive, that thing that blends into, like, two people that they actually find at the start of the... Yeah. They created that. Like, they had that all done practically, and then they had to scrap it.
And it looks awful in CGI. Yeah. Like, shonky and just, like, doesn't fit in, and, like, it clearly looks like someone almost, like, drew it in to every scene.
Yeah.
It's awful.
I wonder how much of that is because they, because I think mainly CGI, if you just give someone enough time and money, they can do it properly. Maybe it would have been better if they'd just gone for CGI from the start, but I don't know. We're not experts on this, so yeah. So
practical effects, like, yes, they do look cheesy, like, kind of looking back at this, you know, even in this movie, it does look a little cheesy, but it looks infinitely better than the CGI would.
Yeah, yeah. And then the trivia I think is most interesting about this is, like I said, this is based on a book, a novella, I think is the correct term. It was about 80 pages called Who Goes There by a man called John W. Campbell, I think.
I think that's right.
Yep.
And then Alec Navala Lee, who is an American author, was writing a biography of different science fiction writers back about 4 years ago in 2017. And they came across an extended version of this, like, as it was originally intended to be published before it was cut down significantly. And they re-released it, fixing a lot of typos that apparently John W. Campbell made a lot of the time when he was writing first drafts. And they turned it into a new book called Frozen Hell, which adds about 40 to 50% of material on there.
Cool.
It's interesting. I don't necessarily think it's a better book because the first kind of 30, 40 pages are very disjointed compared to the rest of it. Because it kind of starts off as this big adventure mystery, like, oh, we found a spacecraft. And then it goes into, you know, descent into madness and horror and that sort of stuff. Obviously, they didn't have quite as advanced science back then. So the way they find out that this thing is capable of assimilating thing is it sends out psychic brainwaves projecting its game plan into people's minds.
Huh.
And I think people should definitely read it, but I think the movie's better. Because the original book's only like 80 pages, the movie actually goes into a lot more depth on who these characters are, shows their descent into madness in a bit more detail. You get to know the characters better as well. But it's still really interesting to read. And I would...
They're also making, from my understanding, a movie of Frozen Hell. It's in production.
Oh, okay. Yes. Yeah. And they're currently writing a sequel to it, actually. Somebody's writing a sequel to Frozen Hell based on the extended version.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking of trivia, I just want to go over some of the quick fan theories, just because I think it was really, really interesting. It's something that I was always aware of and I made an effort to watch out for upon this rewatch. The first big one is that the theory is that Childs, Keith David's character, is a thing and that Kurt Russell's the only human left. And the reason you, quote, know this is because Keith David, does not have any breath coming out of his mouth during the scene. He does. That one's wrong.
Okay.
His eyes aren't shining. They are. They're the same. Or sorry, his eyes are shining. They're not. They're the same as Kurt Russell's. And the other theory is that Kurt Russell's character hands him a bottle of gasoline, not whiskey. And so the thing drinks it and doesn't realize that it's not supposed to enjoy it, which first doesn't hold up because if it has memories, it knows what alcohol tastes like versus gasoline. Second, yeah. We have no idea what it was he handed to the thing, to Childs, to Keith David's character. It could have been gasoline, it could have been whiskey. We don't really know where this bottle came from because he kind of just rummages around on the ground, picks something up, and hands it to him. So,
yeah.
We don't know what it is.
That's a fun theory, though.
Yeah. It is. And there was another one about, it's a two-thing theory, where there's actually two different things from the ship that are competing with one another to try to assimilate.
I've heard of this one.
So one of them is transmitted, quote, via saliva, and apparently Kurt Russell picks it up pretty early on in the movie, so he's been infected the whole time by the sneaky thing. And there's another thing that assimilates people through brute force, and that's the one that Childs is at the end, apparently.
Mm.
That one is very much just like, oh, well, we kind of made this up, and with these weird logic rules we made, it fits the movie pretty well. It's like, there's no evidence for this. It's interesting, but I doubt it. So.
Right.
I don't like that one that much, to be honest.
Me either.
I think one of the most interesting things is that this thing does behave selfishly. Like, it doesn't necessarily act to benefit the other things in the movie a lot of the time. Yeah, and I think that the selfish organisms are out there, like individuals that act to the detriment of the rest of their species. In the book, and it possibly happens in the movie as well, things literally kill each other just to alleviate suspicion from them.
Really?
Oh, cool.
Yeah, well, it's not clear whether they're doing it to alleviate suspicion or just because they're playing the part so well that they kill them because that's what that person would normally do. But it does happen, and it could happen in the movie. I mean, that's one of the nice things about the ambiguity of this film is we don't kind of know a lot of the time.
I know I'm human. And if you were all these things, then you'd just attack me right now. So some of you are still human.
So before we get into the science, if you've got any thoughts or questions, you can get in touch with Adam or I on Twitter. I'm at Big Dr. Fishboy. Adam is at Harsic Adam. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can visit our website, www.cinematicaanimalia.com, or email us at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. If you want to read Libby's work, you can visit Why do I say www? Does anybody think that website addresses don't start?
I don't know.
I was going to ask.
I wonder this every single week. Like, what are you, an 80-year-old
like
grandpa from the
90s? Such a boomer thing, yeah.
worldwideweb.http:////
Okay, I'm doing it once more for posterity, though. If you want to read Libby's work, visit http://// www.shortstorysoup.substack.com, and you can sign up for fortnightly emails. And if you want to hear about the more hardcore science that Adam and I write about, you can check out http://www.ecologyforthemasses.com.
Love the third.
Yes. We're going all the way through. Hang on. If you want to find Adam on Twitter, you can visit http://twitter.com/ No, sorry, Cal. I'll come down now. Right. So, assimilation. Dave, you have some thoughts.
Yeah, so, I mean, the key factor in this film established fairly early on is where they take an example of the alien blood and then basically look at it interacting with human blood. And in the images that they can see a viral cell basically reacting with a human cell, assimilating it, replicating it, and then finding itself in a situation where it then looks totally normal afterward until it comes in contact with another chunk of... human material where the viral element basically shows itself again, it consumes and it spreads. And that's sort of the...
Wait, how the fuck are they filming this and making these graphics? Because it is like the most ridiculous movie with little legends coming in from the side saying, alien organism, this is now assimilation complete, identity obscured. That is...
Would you have preferred psychic brainwaves?
Maybe, but no. I think I would have preferred Wilford Brimley having a thicker mustache and just talking about diabetes the whole time.
So with the assimilation then taking place, this becomes the key idea between or behind when this creature reacts and touches how it's able to assimilate, copy, replicate all of the complex tissues in whatever animal it's coming in contact with. There's no way that this can work in terms of anything that's involved. So the concept of absorption of basically cellular organisms eating one another is kind of the key idea behind all of life in terms of where we started. And the concept as well that's super duper important when it comes to any form of infection that we might suffer. The idea that we've got a system of cells in place that are capable of absorbing, digesting, breaking down the bad material. Now, we've had discussions about viruses before in terms of coming in contact with different organisms and injecting parts of their DNA that can basically hijack the cell.
That's actually a spoiler for next week's episode because we talked about it in the Annihilation episode.
Exactly.
So that little infomercial there in the thing, or the little graphic they do of the cell, like shooting its little red parts into the blue cell, taking it over and then turning back into the blue one, is a perfect explanation of horizontal gene transfer, which we'll talk about this week.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And I mean, that's exactly, in terms of horizontal gene transfer, is a thing by which, and we'll get into that, bacteria can share DNA back and forth to gain things like resistance to antibiotics. The idea that you're somehow able to come in contact, absorb, take over another cell and completely replicate it while still keeping yourself intact would be an incredibly complex arrangement with a really, really low likelihood of success. You can definitely, if you're specialized for it, drop DNA into another cell and replicate it such, or make it replicate parts of you like a virus does, until they explode and you burst and you move on, destroying the host that you were in, host-parasite relations being something that Adam will take us away on. And you can definitely have systems by which one organism ingests to break down and take components from another cell. But trying to replicate and absorb while still keeping a piece of yourself present, one, super timely, two, incredibly energetically costly, and three, just I just can't think of any way in which that would be possible. And we don't have any examples of cellular mimicry that's present anywhere on the planet. Not that I can find.
The closest we would have with this stuff working out is the way, way, way back in the before times, our cells and plant cells absorbed another extracellular organism that became respectively mitochondria, right, and chloroplasts. It was a specialized organism that did a specific thing that has now had evolved a symbiotic relationship, right, with our cells. So they now live inside of our cells, but we're not mimicking them or assimilating them. They just live inside of it. It's a symbiotic relationship.
The mitochondria, or as Sam always refers to it,
or the powerhouse of the cell.
Thank you.
What do you mean, as Sam always refers to it? Did you guys not have biology textbooks with like that drilled into you over and over again?
Seventh grade.
But every time we bring it up, I can hear you whispering while someone's talking about it. You're like, the powerhouse of the cell.
In a room, you might find a fireplace, which provides heat, keeps it warm, energy. In a cell, you might find mitochondria, which power the cell.
The cellular assimilation mechanism just doesn't make any sense. Like, I can't, going over it and trying to take a look at it, the idea that this organism would be able to come in contact with and replace all of the different cells, as well as it has to keep their architecture. So we're incredibly complex organisms, right? I mean, although we do derive from original single cells, egg and sperm, and then we kind of grow out from there using complex genes that basically control our architecture, it's a very slow process, right? Developing life is not something that you rush in a matter of seconds. It takes a long period of time to grow digits properly, to grow bone arrangements, muscle arrangements. And so trying to replace all that while still keeping all of those cellular mechanisms in place, maybe super duper slowly over months time, digesting, reabsorbing and rebuilding in almost like a chrysalis fashion, but touching something and then immediately being able to replicate it within minutes.
I have a question. How long does, like, you know, like when lizards lose their tail and regrow it, or starfish like regrow almost entirely, how long does that normally take in nature?
Days to weeks.
Yeah. Yeah, Deadpool style.
You have flatworms, which are the platyhelminths is the name of that group of organisms. They can regenerate an entire body, basically. So if you cut a flatworm into five pieces, you have five new flatworms.
Yeah.
Yeah. There are also sea slugs that you just chop off the head. From the head, they will grow a new body. Just a floating head that grows a new body.
Right. Yeah.
And here we go. This is from the University of Guelph. Huh. Okay. Article from the University of Guelph. Geckos are able to regrow a new tail within 30 days, faster than any other type of lizard.
Right. and regrowing your own tissue. You're not trying to replicate, understand, replace, and then grow from there, right? You're, so again, I just, and also, and we'll get into this, it's just would be so energetically costly to try and do these big transformations. There'd be huge amounts of heat, as well as there would have to be a need for external energy, which wouldn't allow for the conservation of mass that we see, where these organisms are able to grow, grab, and then basically replicate.
Yeah, just a notion that I've kind of had just now is that these species, if they were on another planet with, you know, presumably a biodiverse kind of fauna, they would take everything over on that planet. And I mean, on the planet Earth, there's only one species that has been able to, you know, move to all parts of the world, kill basically anything at once, and that's humans. So potentially what we're looking at is a, you know, a form of civilization that has just advanced, you know, to be equally as destructive in another direction. And the book kind of backs this up a little bit. I think there's one line, hang on, where they say, what's his face? I think he's played by Wilford Brimley in the movie as
Blair.
This is a member of a supremely intelligent race, a race that has learnt the deeper secrets of biology and then turned them to its use. So potentially as a way to expand their populace, this is how they've gone about it. But it's kind of a cop-out because, you know, we try to use animal or plant-based mechanisms to make this stuff work. So, you know, saying, oh, they're an alien, they're using alien technology isn't really fun.
No, and the 2011 one, to give it credit, the thing that I think I enjoyed more to its effect is most of the time when they're trying to do a replication that's involved, it's the organism trying to pull whatever it's trying to copy into itself to then begin the replication. And when the creature first breaks through from the ice, it's not like it's touching a human and then trying to replicate it. It full on grabs a guy and then drags him into its big weird clam jaws to start like chomping it up where it can start pulling it in and then start the process of replicating.
It's probably also because it's easy to replicate something if it's not moving around. Right.
I mean, but also it's pulling in the tissue and basically churning it out. And they get into a little bit more of expanding on the idea that they think that it's processing it, trying to get enough of that cellular material and then basically build its copies from there.
It's actually interesting because it's never gone into in any sense, like, obviously there's some pretty violent assimilations that occur, but they never go into whether or not the assimilation is a painful process.
It seems to be.
Whether you even,
I imagine it would
be. Yeah, or whether you even know what's happening. But I mean, you know, the ones we see for is
Gary, the guy who gets fingers through his face, he seems to be not enjoying that
process. Yeah, but if, you know, it just sidled up behind you and, you know, put its arms around your waist and gave you a nice little embrace and then kind of just wormed its way in there. Do you think? Because, I mean, all the transformations we see are violent and horrifying, right? Like that guy who gets his fucking head chomped and then his entire body shook around like a fucking ragdoll. I mean, do you think it's...
Which was a literal ragdoll.
You would hope so, yeah. I mean, crash test dummy, I guess, isn't a ragdoll. But anyway, like, I mean, I think the pain would be mainly from the, you know, being thrown around like a ragdoll and not from the assimilation.
So what's the Norwegian guy from Game of Thrones that, Sam, you've talked about before being a giant rock star where you are?
Tormund.
Yeah, what's the actor's name?
Christopher Hivju.
So he's in the 2011 movie, and he does have one of the aliens that like grips onto his face and starts assimilating. And they have this like horrifying scene where like they've cleared out the room of like most of them and they like turn to like where Tormund's got this thing on him. And it's covered his mouth, but his eyes are like still moving as it's like assimilating its way into him. And there is just like this look of pain that the actor portrays really, really well. And like his entire body is like flailing and shaking the way that you would be in great discomfort before they end up hitting him with the flamethrower. And it does not look like a comfortable process.
So as we were talking about with underwater, this thing would probably be better off with some sort of paralytic.
Which the problem is you can't use that at a cellular level.
Yeah, of course, because if you're a human to a cellular level, you can't just be, you know, pulling paralytics out of your ass.
No. And I mean that doesn't appear to be the way that the creature is working. So it's a brilliant mechanism. It is so cool on the movies, but there's difficulties even with architectural breakdown. If I assimilate Adam, I can't then create some sort of secondary mechanism where Adam looks totally normal, but I can still open his chest at a heartbeat and open up with a series of teeth and other apparatus that can bite into things. We're designed in a very specific way because that's the only way that we can work, right? heart, lungs, other tissue needs to go. If you start growing teeth in your chest, it's going to start messing with things.
Yeah.
I could see that one kind of working because the doctor tries to defibrillate him a couple of times, and that's one of those movie magic nonsense. Yeah. If a person isn't breathing or moving, a defibrillator is not going to help. That's if you have cardiac arrhythmia. But as he's doing that, maybe the creature's like starting to rework the ribcage into teeth a little bit and move some things out, and then at the right moment opens up and chomps.
Or maybe they're all just walking around with stomach teeth all the time.
Maybe.
Regardless, even if it was that system, teeth take a really long time to grow. Yeah.
Well, I think to that point, you know, they keep stressing that they're perfect replicas, but like you could just cut open somebody at any time and it would not look normal. Kind of like an Annihilation.
Yeah.
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 I mean, to that point, you have the absorbed one when they had that dog mess creature they try to take apart and they slice it open and there's what looks like a partially formed dog inside of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and in the big monster at the end, the little dog creature comes popping out the side of it as well. So it's just a matter of you have no idea what's on the inside.
Just continuing on, and then that's the second thing that we kind of hinted at before. There's no rules of conservation of mass that are being applied here. And we've discussed this in movies like The Xenomorph before, like in the first Alien, that we see like the little thing tears out of the chest of John Hurt and like runs across the way. And then like an hour later, they find it and it's like 7 feet tall. And you're like, where the fuck did you get all the mass to build that thing?
Yeah.
Like if you just decimated the ship's rat population?
Maybe it was just real dense at the start.
Weighs 10 pounds as a 7 foot adult. Yeah.
He just took a really deep breath and it was like a balloon. Yeah.
The concept of being able to create, not only to replicate and take over and have no energy loss whatsoever from absorbing a human and sort of becoming it, but then second, finding yourself in a situation where that giant creature that Kurt Russell forms at the end, where the fuck did he get all the mass for that thing?
Oh, I think it was just like joining up all the corpses that it's, you know,
all of them?
It was hiding it under the
base.
That thing
is yeah, huge. Probably.
It's got all the dogs in the book. There's cows under there as well. Yeah.
So, like, the growth and the energy just doesn't make sense in terms of, like, where it's going to be getting these and how it's going to be, like, rapidly making these changes. Now, a part that I really enjoyed in the 2011 one, just harking back, is it adds in the creatures have the inability to replicate inorganic material.
Mm.
So, one of the ways that they start finding out that this thing is replicating in the way that it is the first guy that it eats, they find that it's like spat out the plate that makes up his arm from when he fractured it before. Mm. And then the test that they end up trying to create, because they don't just go to Kurt Russell's rather brilliant test, the one where he sort of separates the little bit of blood and then zaps it with the heat.
Yeah. Because you can't do that again, because then...
Right. So instead, they have this stupid scene that involves the lead female character looking in everybody's mouth to try and prove that, like, if you still have your dental fillings in, you must be human, which only allows her to, like, rule out the humans that, like, one, have really bad teeth, which a couple of the characters make the problem of. They're like, cool, I'm going to get flamethrowered because I floss. Fuck you. But two, also hides the factor that, like, these things are clearly intelligent enough, they would just pick up the fillings afterward and just stuff them back in, like, just crunch them into a tooth and be like, oh, you guys aren't a dentist, you don't know how fucked up that looks, like, I'll be fine.
Yeah.
But it is a cool concept that if this thing is trying to do a cellular reproduction, that trying to replicate the complexities of metal, it wouldn't be able to use a normal body plan to do that. But if that's the case, and the stupidest scene that's possible, the lead Kurt Russell analog at the end gets outed for having been turned into one of these creatures because he has an earring in his ear that they use to like track him throughout the film. And then at the end, the lead like female character turns on him and she's like, you know how I know you're not human? You don't have the earring. And it like reaches up for its ear, and then she's like, it was the other ear, before she like hits it with the flamethrower.
Yeah.
First of all, you're telling me this thing isn't smart enough afterward to just like grab the fucking earring and pop it back in place? And second of all, like, it had all the memories. It would definitely know which of the ears it was on. The last quick mechanism I wanted to touch on, and we briefly talked about, and we will talk about this in the Annihilation episode going forward, is just the concept of memory and physical features. And we discussed this briefly in the parasitology one as well. Memory is incredibly complex, and we know how incredibly complex it is to remember and to keep information. the idea that this organism is somehow able to assimilate neurological tissue, keep all those normal synapses intact, keep the normal structures that are associated, while also simultaneously keeping a memory of itself that's present. Because we know that it has information from its prior jumps, because it builds a spaceship in the movie. Like, we can see it rebuilding and making a spaceship down below that it's trying to use to potentially get away. Which means it's got to be storing an amazing amount of information inside of a poor little human brain to try and do all those things. Also, spaceship building is really complicated. If I, like, took one NASA astronaut and, like, sat him down and I'm like, build me a spaceship, he'd be like, I'm the rocket engineer, asshole. I don't do anything with the rest of the ship. Like, I do one fucking thing.
I'm a botanist.
I can build one part of it, yeah.
Right.
So the assumption is that it has the assumed knowledge of the rest of its species within it.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, I think it could be interesting from the point of view of trapping the memory, going back to our theory earlier about it blending in so well. It might be the kind of thing where, much like huge jacked man in The Prestige, where it doesn't know that it is a copy until it needs to act out and assimilate somebody. It thinks that it is human. That's why it blends in so well.
Yeah.
Sleeper cells, literally.
Yeah, and it is interesting because it is heavily implied both in the book and the movie that sometimes the things don't know which one is a thing, or they act in a way that, again, it might just be that they're acting in a way that they don't know which one's the thing. Like I said, they do kill other things in the movie just to blend in. So, yeah. Adam and I, we were talking about this. We don't have a huge amount of ecological stuff to touch on because it's kind of hard to come up and imagine into being a world where this species has somehow evolved. But there are kind of some weird analogs on our planet. The first thing that came to mind when I was thinking of enormous species that give the impression, enormous individuals that give the impression of being a ton of different individuals were mushrooms. We often see the head of a mushroom popping up and, you know, maybe five or six of them in a region and think, oh, those are five or six separate organisms. They're not. Mushrooms are connected underground by essentially thousands of meters in some cases of mycelium.
Some of them are.
Yeah.
Some of them are.
Some species of mushrooms. So the biggest organism in the world is actually a mushroom that takes up, I think, 3 million meters squared in Malheur National Forest, Oregon, is a mushroom species, Armillaria ostoiae. And it's spread throughout. It's all connected, one organism. It's all connected by mycelium underground. So even though you might see mushroom caps popping up everywhere, they're literally just the sex organs of mushroom. Mm-hmm. So yeah, what you eat are mushroom dicks. Well, I mean, it's gross. Hell yeah. Gross oversimplification, and I do mean gross. But yeah, you get the idea. And aspen. So we were talking about trees. Aspen do it as well. They're normal clonal organisms. They grow from a single seedling. But again, they're enormous and they all look pretty much the same, but they're not replicating anything. So,
No, that doesn't quite work. The only thing that kind of makes sense in some ways is the dormancy that the thing takes in the cold.
Yeah, absolutely.
And some organisms do what's called encystment, where they basically go into this inactive, desiccated, dehydrated, and basically zombified state to remain whenever the environment's too harsh. They go into this stage and they kind of will come out of it whenever the environment becomes more favorable.
Yeah.
A lot of Daphnia, these freshwater crustaceans, are they're not insects, but think about them as little water fleas. They will drop eggs into the soil at the bottom of a body of water, and those will eventually be covered up by more and more dirt. But you can take these out and resuscitate them, and you'll have an organism that was effectively hundreds of years old brought back to life because of these resting eggs. Water bears do this, tardigrades, which can survive the vacuum of space. So I think as far as a mechanism, if this is an organism that has been literally traversing the stars for millennia, billions of years, because the space is big, it'd be a long, 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 long time before you find another planet, much less a planet that could support life. It makes sense if it could go into an encysted state, travel the stars, hit a planet, and then become active
again. Yeah. Yep. And you do see that on our planet, the examples that Adam was talking about are all really small. As you get into larger forms of life, there are still things that are capable of doing that sort of stuff. You've got fish or frogs that can overwinter and have like antifreeze within their body that helps, you know, I mean,
literal antifreeze. Yeah,
literal antifreeze. And they look, for all intents and purposes, dead. But you know, they'll thaw out, they'll start again, they'll be fine. And then you get into larger forms again, mammals, chipmunks, bears go into hibernation. But it's very temporary. Most of these things wake up and move around a little bit while they're so-called hibernating. And they actually, they touch on this a little bit in the book. It is 1930s science, so it's not, you know, it's not amazing, but it comes pretty close. What one of them says is, you can't thaw higher forms of life and have them come too. Higher form of life, very subjective term.
Very outdated concept in biology.
A fish can come too because it's so low a form of life, so slightly organized that the individual cells of its body can revive, and that's enough to reestablish life. Again, very outdated concept, but you know, it's...
Fish are incredibly complex.
Yeah, systems. But I mean, it's the 1930s. I can't, you know, we can't fault them too much. Any higher forms thawed out that way are dead because though the individual cells revive, they die because they must have organization to live. So there is kind of a stab at explaining this sort of stuff. And it kind of, no, I don't know. It's fine. But the fact holds that for something this big, it would have to have some sort of cellular, I don't want to use cellular organization after we've just shut on that sort of term, but it would have to be composed in a way that we've never, ever seen before for something like this to be able to come back after millions of years in the ice.
Sure, and it wouldn't be able to, again, harking back to the 2011, but they try to, in the 82 film, when they find that big ice block and they see that like something's crawled out of the ice block and they don't know what it is, and you see it like full on jumps through the roof in the 2011. Like, it gets up and it just busts its way out. Water bears, brine shrimp, other animals that are able to survive for prolonged periods of time, the main mechanism is getting rid of water. You'd have to move to a point where you're in an inactive state until water is resumed. I could totally see this organism, if it's existing in a cellular state and they just happen to come in contact with some of it in the water, basically, as it's been rehydrated, kind of a water of Mars thing from that Doctor Who episode we made fun of way back in the day.
Yeah,
but it wouldn't be able to jump right back up and then just resume normal activity.
No, not so much. Especially the antifreeze things work. Those organisms have those adaptations because when water freezes, it expands, and that will destroy the cell that is mostly composed of water. Mm-hmm. So having, if it's mimicking a human and it actually has literal human cells, freezing would kill it. It would just be demolished. So whatever form it needs to take, whatever changes it has to make at a cellular level, have to be made for it to survive in this environment.
Now, Adam, you do bring up a cool point, which I hadn't thought of before, and this links back to Libby's point. Maybe to store itself in the ice, it does have to change. Maybe the reason it doesn't want to fight Kurt Russell at the end is it's trying to conserve energy that, like, if the two of them start freezing to death, it's capable of undergoing some form of cellular change that is going to make it resistant going forward, because it is too similar human. Like you were anticipating, is it rearranging things in the chest to make teeth? Is it making alterations internally? Maybe it's conserving its energy because it's like, fuck you, we're both going to freeze. I don't need to fight you and use everything up. I'm just going to do what I need to do so I can make it from one side to the other. Similar to, I remember reading an article from park rangers discussing bat species and trying to encourage people to stop going spelunking during the winter months. Because if they wake up those bats that are present at that point, they will lose that cellular energy they need to get all the way through the winter. And they're like, even though it only seems like a little thing, if like they jump up and they fly around a bit, or even if they like open their eyes and flap their wings when you've disturbed them,
it's still enough.
They will starve to death. And so they were like, you spelunkers are decimating these certain bat colonies where you're waking them up. They're having to move from one area to the other. They have not planned to have those resources. And then we're finding them all dead come springtime.
Yeah. That makes sense for sure.
Anyways.
And it could be the kind of thing where, like you're saying, if it is Keith David's character or if it is Kurt Russell's, whoever it is, having a relatively inactive state while your body is undergoing these massive internal changes while you're trying to prepare for this deep freeze, that would make sense where there's no attack. So in that case, one of them being the thing would
work. Yeah, that's a cool idea.
So as far as making this organism more realistic, it has to... It'll take a lot longer to absorb a creature. Yep. It might not be a perfect imitation. and it might not be a seamless process.
Yeah.
So, is this movie still scary, or does it work at all to have a much slower, creeping, impending doom as opposed to this very rapid? You could be gone 10 minutes, and you come back, your buddy's an alien,
right? Yeah. Libby.
I mean, I think the timeline of it would have to absolutely change. You know, you have to be in a situation where these people are going to be out there for months at a time. And I think the creature would have to be very, very tactical in who it changes first.
Yep.
So making sure that they have time to do it, they have time to assimilate, and presenting itself in a situation where it is taken over, you know, more. You know, three or more of them by the time they figure out that it can replicate. So basically, I think that it shows its hand too early when they understand that it is replicating. Mm-hmm. So putting it in a situation where they don't know that it is until it's too late, kind of thing.
Now, yeah. Alternate idea then, building on Libby's idea, if these things are slower, they're having to take a human, basically bring them back somewhere, engage them in almost a chrysalis to reorganize tissues and trying to absorb and rebuild in a format that will work for them going forward. That would be kind of a cool, if it hit a major populated area, humans did get involved and recognize this type of thing, and you had sort of one of those pseudo military movies where the military's moving around from like apartment to apartment trying to find who's got the creature growing in the bathtub. And sort of flamethrower it, knowing that it takes a really long time, but knowing that they're out there. And then sort of a creeping horror, almost from the perspective of those creatures, Blade Runner style, as they kind of run around trying to replicate themselves, knowing they're physiologically superior, but they're very vulnerable in situations where they have to replicate or copy.
Yeah, in those situations. Huh?
We are also getting pretty close to the pod people, if we do this. Invasions from the body snatchers. Yeah.
Body snatchers, yes.
Yeah.
We are.
Libby... Oh, sorry, actually, I've got a question for Libby. And then, Dave, do you think it would be easier if this creature dedicated itself to just assimilating one species?
Yes, 100%. Okay. Like, if it was directed in such a fashion that it was just learning to replicate those specific tissues and got really good at that, 100%, right? Because you've got to be programmed, as well as we never got to see, and I was thinking about it as I was watching the film last night, these cellular organisms would be having a dickish time fighting our normal immune system. Like, it'd be really hard to, like, take it over. Like, there would be scenes of, like, the viral particles, like, coming up across, or a white blood cell finding one of these infected tissues and attacking it. These humans would be suffering from inflammatory and anaphylactic reactions as this thing is trying to take them over. Our immune system is pretty fucking good. It would go kicking and screaming into that big good night.
Yeah. Libby, if it does just assimilate one species, does that detract from the story a bit?
Ooh.
In this case, I think it would, because it limits its escape.
Yeah.
I think when you have it confined to a singular space, it eliminates a lot of the paranoia, because you know it's a certain thing, whereas opposed to it could be anything.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. I think that is one of the things that I do enjoy, because they don't touch on this so much in the movie, is that all that needs to happen is a bird visits the camp,
right,
and they're everything's fucked. Like, that's it. Like, and they actually, in the book, an albatross visits the camp and they just murder it instantly. Like, everybody just knows we have to fucking kill that bird straight away. Yeah. And like, the first thing they do, I think from memory, somebody destroys the helicopter engines.
Yeah.
Blair does.
Dude, Blair is the unsung hero of that movie.
And that's the thing. It really is. In the book, right, Blair again goes mad, destroys the helicopter, and they think, oh, well, actually, can somebody go and check, make sure he's done it properly? Because we need to stay here. He's done the right thing. Make sure he's fucking, like, really destroyed that chopper. Yeah.
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 And I kind of like that. I do think that the movie is better because it expands more, but the book has got some really interesting shit in it. Okay.
It's really cool.
My one plot complaint about the movie was they pull the classic Scooby-Doo of let's constantly split up, go by ourselves, stay in individual rooms when we know this thing attacks people when they're alone.
And it's dumb enough in normal horror films, but when splitting up into smaller groups is the worst thing you can do, it's really inexcusable.
Now, this last sort of point is the last sort of cellular one I wanted to talk about, because the internet goes crazy on this point, which is when the blood is separated from the body, which is this like awesome scene in the movie where Kurt Russell figures out that if he takes sample, and then he applies a heat source, he says that by watching the other organisms react, he figures that, you know, if my arm's chopped off, it's still my arm. But if this thing is chopped off, it's going to try to defend itself, get away. So the internet and apparently like a group of like the creators moving forward for other movie groups had simply assumed that these things get more intelligent as you add more cellular tissue together, which is why it's dumb when it's like in the little like piece of blood. Now, that's a really cool idea. It's not how anything works in nature. One of the stupidest organisms that I get to do work with are horses. That is a huge organism versus like we do all kinds of fascinating intelligence experiments with mice and rats. In nature, there is something called the encephalization quotient, which is basically just a measure of relative brain size as a ratio to sort of the total mass of the organism compared against the size of the brain. And apparently there is some mild correlation that takes place, but it wouldn't be occurring within drops of blood in a petri dish.
And there's so many like exceptions to this. For instance, we've talked about this before. Neanderthals had larger brains than us. Doesn't mean they were smarter. One of the theories is that because they spent so much time in caves, the area of the brain that was associated with vision was the part that was much larger. So just because you have a larger brain doesn't mean you're a lot smarter.
Right.
Okay, well, then before we sign off, one last thing we should touch on, because we touched on it last time as well, is that humans are not the best choice for assimilation in terms of, if you want to go for mass, we mentioned last time that 60% of the entire mass of mammals on the planet is cattle. So if you're just trying to build one big organism, you can't go wrong with cattle. In terms of dispersal ability and just, you know, population size, insects are everywhere and humans don't tend to notice the difference between them.
Nope. Insects don't tend to notice the difference between them.
Insects, and I mean, obviously, they disperse really well. They can just hitch on to anything. We don't notice them most of the time unless they're a real pain in the ass, like bees and wasps and that sort of stuff. And that's, you know, you wouldn't...
Bees are not a pain in the ass. They're wonderful.
Yes, bees are...
But for getting off Antarctica, I mean, you wouldn't need a bird or a fish. And I think that, you know, they do away with that whole thing by making the research base so isolated. And there are times in Antarctica where you just don't get birds and fish. And if you're too far inland, it's not going to happen anyway, so...
Which they seem to be. There's nothing near
them. The dog is a really good idea, though. He should have just
stuck with the dog.
Done that at the very start.
Speaking of the dog, this movie was wonderful, and all the actors did a great job, but I think that dog was one of the best actors in the movie.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Just the opening scenes of it, like, walking around, looking kind of sinister, like, the way that it just moves through the sets, like, that dog did an incredible job.
I don't know what the hell's in there, but it's weird and pissed off, whatever it is.
Would we recommend this movie?
Yeah,
100%. Yes. Yeah.
Yep.
Even if you're not a fan of scary movies, this isn't like one of those things that's just like packed with jump scares or anything. It's just more about that constant dread building and
just creeping dread.
And there's some great horrifying looking shit. Yeah, yeah. Did we feel sorry for the monster at any point?
Yes,
I kind of did.
Well, Adam, you were mentioning
it's
that
it's just an organism.
Adam, you mentioned a while ago that if you do want to feel sorry for the monster, there's a text you should read written from the perspective of the thing, right?
Yeah, it's a wonderful little short story written from the perspective of the thing itself, and it just does not understand why these humans don't want to assimilate with it, because that's from its point of view.
Looking for friends.
That's what the ultimate form of life is, becoming bigger, becoming more than yourself by joining with others, and that's just what you should want to do. Why don't these humans want to do this?
Okay, yeah. Dave, did you feel bad for the monster?
Yeah. I felt there were, like, many points where, it is trying to spread, it's trying to live, it's woken up, it's got to be terrified in terms of the new environment that it's woken up in. It's a hostile area, and it's trying to do what it apparently has a biological drive for. Mm. And I was rewatching, because they use it for the 2011 as well, whichever sound engineer came up with this scream that this thing makes every time it gets set on fire is so good. That blood-curdling, like, whoa,
Churdling.
Churdling. Blood churning.
Blood chortling. Blood
chortling, yeah.
Laugh. Churdle is what I'm going to do when this episode's over.
Like, it's just so frightening and scary, yeah, but also really you feel for it. Like, it clearly is in pain when it's letting out a cry like that. Sam, did you end up feeling bad for the monster?
No, like I said, I don't feel bad for this monster. It's probably going to survive anyway, and it fucked up those dogs. Like, it, you know, you shouldn't hurt dogs.
Yeah,
bad.
That's fair. Bad animal. That's totally fair.
Yeah.
All right. Next week, like I said, hopefully we'll have that that episode with Kirsty MacLeod, looking at Annihilation. Mm-hmm. That was a really fun episode. It's a long episode, but it was really enjoyable.
So, harking back to some of the people that we've missed due to the busyness of all of our schedules, Libby's been doing a fantastic job reorganizing all of our emails, and basically had gone through and found an email from a doctor, Sam Dawson.
Doctor. Thank you, doctor.
Mm. Thank you, doctor.
Basically, thank you, Dr. Sam Dawson, giving us a shout out to do the Lake Placid episode, interestingly enough, right before we decided to do the Lake Placid episode. So, tons of thanks for that, and we love hearing from fans getting suggestions. Absolutely. As they encourage us to step outside of our comfort zone and do movies that we otherwise might not do.
That was clearly a very good suggestion, because we ended up doing it.
Yes, exactly. If you have suggestions, please, cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. Hit us up, let us know.
Yeah, okay, Adam, do you want to sign us off?
Yeah. Remember, the monsters aren't real, but the science is.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
This thing doesn't want to show itself. It wants to hide inside an imitation. It'll fight if it has to, but it's vulnerable out in the open. If it takes us over, then it has no more enemies. Nobody left to kill it. And then it's won.
You guys gotta listen to Gary. He can beat one of those things!